are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, April 1, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Khaled Badoun on American Islamophobia, understanding the roots and rise of fear. Also on the program today, official whistleblower status for the White House career security staffer who blew the whistle on 25 security clearance reversals. Meanwhile, Trump threatens to shut down the Mexican border en route to cutting aid to Central America. Mitch McConnell decries the Democratic obstruction to his nuking of Senate rules. Elizabeth Warren's finance director quits over her refusal to court big donors. Meanwhile, Pete Buttigieg raises $7 million since announcing. Joe Biden, meanwhile, claims he never believed he acted inappropriately to women.
I'm sure he didn't.
Weird way to phrase that. Sanders, not my quote, his quote. Sanders vows to slash drug prices in half. And Arkansas responds to federal courts tossing their work for Medicaid by tossing Medicaid. Meanwhile, speaking of campaign finance, ACLU will spend $30 million in the upcoming election. And lastly, Trump's rumored pick for the Fed, a deadbeat dad. All this and more on today's Majority Report. First off, it's almost impossible to say this on this day and have you believe me for good reason. But we will not be doing an April Fool's show today. we were trying to think about like what we would do, and then we were going back and forth, and then Michael supposedly, and I cannot guarantee that this is not an April Fool's joke, or that this is definitely not a setup, but he may be playing a joke on me or on us as a way of just like staying out of work today. But supposedly,
got you good.
Supposedly, I don't know. Is it inappropriate for me to say what the cause is? Because like,
it's patient doctor confidentiality.
Is maybe. It really?
I don't know. I'm not an expert.
He's got something that sounds pretty benign, but he had to go to the emergency room for it. So it's nothing serious, as far as I can tell. But
we hope.
I think he like was. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But so I'm sorry. We're not doing an April Fool's version of the show, and I know you're all expecting it to happen right now, and it's so awkward.
Everyone's saying you said that on Halloween, Sam.
Did I say that on Halloween?
I don't remember if you did, but people saying you said it.
All right. Well,
fool me once.
Wait, did we do one on Halloween? We did do one on Halloween. Okay. All right. Well, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that time because now, but I think we're probably just going to move it to Halloween. So,
I mean, who needs April Fool's?
Now I keep thinking something's going to happen. So awkward right now.
We'll see. The world is enough of a joke already.
So we obviously got some feedback from and I specifically didn't call him a guest. I hope you know that when Michael Tracy came on the show, because he was, you know, insulting the show. Insulting a guest from the show, insulting our callers, and I brought him on. I think arguably I got a little bit too hot too quick. I lost my patience with him. But if you look at any of the debates, there's a couple of debates out there, one with Mehdi Hasan, one with Amy Goodman. The question of should there have been an investigation comes up very early. In fact, Glenn Greenwald addresses it in the second time he speaks in the Amy Goodman thing. First, they set the table. Now, that debate happened 3 or 4 days before Michael Tracy came on the show. So I thought, like, we didn't have to go through all the history that was there. He wanted to take it to my having to apologize for Marcy Wheeler coming on the show. And incidentally, I went back and I listened to at least two of her interviews. And I think the other ones, I don't even think were directly involving the Mueller investigation, but I'm not sure. And I was quite impressed. And I remain even more convinced that she was a great guest on this topic and has read into it more than anybody who is critiquing the existence of the investigation. I have no doubt and believe quite strongly that the media, certain elements of the media, not Fox. Fox, I think, went the other direction. But certain elements of the media overplayed the significance of it. I mean, on this program, we've said consistently he's not going to get impeached. To the extent that there is any collusion, we would be shocked if it was knowing. And I think I think there is a very good case, and we'll find out, of course, because we don't know what's in the Mueller report. All we know is that in a very narrow question, one which I think no one here thought that they were actually like working with the Russians to time to, you know, like how to hack, like do this, do that.
Well, I did.
Oh, well, except for Jamie.
April Fool's.
But boom. And so, you know, the media critique, I think, is valid. And we've always said that. And the way that we've dealt with that critique is rather than spend a lot of time on the critique, we've mentioned it in passing. We've just simply actually done something different. Right. Like, I get the argument that in some ways, you know, and I get it. I'm not convinced of it necessarily. But that the broad agenda of the left had been consumed and whatnot. Well, you simply need to go back and look at the programming that we've had on this show, and you tell me what we've been consumed with.
We've probably done more on Social Security, literally.
Oh, without a doubt,
labor.
I mean, just every topic, and so. Yes, I probably. Should have, let Michael Tracy go on for 35 minutes without answering the question. And yes, I found the idea of being agnostic about whether an investigation should take place. I don't know what that means, really. Like, you can be agnostic as, like, I can't figure out the existence of something. But as to whether it should happen, if you think it should happen, then your critique is about the media coverage. Fair enough. And about how some people went out ahead of it. Fair enough. I think that's all accurate. If you don't think it should happen, then you need to explain, like, what should the response have been to things like, you know, Michael Flynn. And to things about, you know, what we ultimately found out about who hacked the emails. I mean, whether it impacted the election is something that we litigated many, many times over and over again. And to the extent that we talked about things that impacted the election, far more about the economy and race were the issues. And, you know, tactical things by the Clinton campaign and on and on. I mean,
yeah, record of Hillary Clinton.
Yes. I mean, anybody who has listened to this program knows that. And so, however, it is my understanding that notable people in private have been supporting Michael Tracy. This is according to his Twitter feed. According to his tweet.
notable people that he can't note.
Well, I have no doubt about it, but my response to that would be, why do you think they're doing it in private? Are they afraid that I'm going to fire them from something? I mean, I hope this, you know, I know, I hope this doesn't ruin people's perception of me, but my media power these days is fairly limited to, like, almost literally the remote control for my TV. Beyond that, I don't wield an enormous amount of media power. So there's no way you're going to, I should be intimidating anybody.
Yeah, people seem to think you're like the president of MSNBC or something.
I can assure you folks that my relationship with MSNBC literally, I don't think could be, I don't want to say tenuous, although that's possible, but it couldn't be, there are filing cabinets in 30 Rock that garner more attention, their presence there, than I do.
Yeah, well, maybe you're just trying to get more attention.
After 15 years of appearing on that network and having filled in for Olbermann and Hayes on his shows, almost 8 or 9 years ago, I've pretty much, come to, reconcile myself for the role that I have. If I was ever going to try and leverage something, and I'm perfectly happy with that. If I was ever going to try and, leverage something, it would have been when they wanted to hire me back after the Cernovich thing. And I literally asked for nothing. I think actually I wanted to just be able to include what I had to say in the press release. That was it. All right. So with that, and I should add, as part of the fallout from the Twitter exchanges that we were having, when people were chastising me for being rude to Michael Tracy, I said, I'm not rude to really any guests that don't deserve it. But I have made it absolutely clear in an official Twitter disclaimer that if you start your solicitation to come on this show by being an a-hole, it would be irrational for you, and you should to expect, and in fact, you should not expect me to be anything but rude to you when you come on. And yeah, it's my show, and I can put, instead of the Majority Report, I could put The Rude Show. But you, if you want to read it that way, you can. But if someone's going to be an a-hole, And that's the way you get on. Guess what? I'm going to treat them like an a-hole. And if you don't like that, then I suggest that you change your YouTube channel or you listen to a different podcast.
This is not Beanbag.
Because this is not Beanbag. So
yeah, we really got to change that decal to the Rudeness Report with
the
Sam
Rude.
Peter.
The Rude. And so anyways, out of that... some exchange. I can't even remember exactly how it happened. But Glenn Greenwald reached out to me in a very nice way and was like, I'd be happy to talk about it. And I was like, great. I'm happy to talk about it with Glenn. So he's going to be on sometime this week, or I'm not exactly sure. We're working on the scheduling right now. So, all right. On to, and what the amazing thing about this is that we have spent far more time on the Mueller report as a function of people criticizing the Mueller report for being agnostic about it existing and then being mad that it existed.
I feel like we were the real agnostics.
We totally were the real agnostics.
Yeah, I believe that's called the Streisand effect. Although, that might have a different meaning now that she's canceled. The Mueller effect, let's call it.
What is
the
that?
Tracy effect.
What does that mean?
The more you bitch about something that you don't want people to pay attention to, the more they pay attention to it.
Right. Try not to think of an elephant.
The Tracy effect.
I mean, look, there are people who have suggested to me that because Michael Tracy started his Patreon a month and a half ago, or 35 days ago, that this was an attempt to get people back to his Twitter feed so that they would see the Patreon sales. I don't know. I mean, no, he started his Patreon. And so there are people who have implied to me, or no, specifically said, he's just doing this because he's trying to build his Patreon. And look, we're all in some form of that business whatsoever. And it, I don't know if that's the case any more than, you know, my letting him on was to help our membership. But it's not working for him. So, you know. Anyways, ladies and gentlemen. This is pretty astonishing, and this is why you tune into a news outlet like Fox News that wouldn't get caught up in the Mueller report because they're blowing the lid off of what's going on with this foreign aid. Everybody says foreign aid is like less than 1% of our budget. Yeah, that's true. But why are we giving foreign aid to Mexico? Three times over. What's going on?
It's the screen is black where we're about to play the clip.
It's black.
Yeah, look.
Oh, no, what are the other one?
Oh, okay.
My bad. Never mind.
Okay. So this whole thing where we are paying one country three times, this is just crazy. This is based on the story that the White House, not only thinking about closing down the border, but is going to punish Central America, because the best way to deal with to the extent that, you know, to deal with the idea that people are streaming towards the American border because our foreign policy over the years has completely destabilized these societies is, of course, to withhold money. Unless these the leaders there start to crack down on the weakest and most vulnerable people in these countries.
Cutting payments, aid payments to El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras over the fact that those countries have been unable to contain the flood of migrants heading through Mexico to our southern border. So yesterday we talked about potentially shutting down the southern border. Or 2 days ago. Excuse me. No, that's yesterday. Weekend is just 2 days.
Pause it. I'm going to read to you the Chiron from Fox and Friends. So this is not just someone speaking. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like a Trump cuts U.S. aid to three Mexican countries. First of all, is Mexico been posing as three countries to get three times the aid? I mean, what's going on? They're blowing the roof off this.
They're wearing slightly different sombreros.
What exactly? It's just nuts. It's just unbelievable, isn't it?
I've been to all of the Mexicos, and I find them all quite unique in their own way. I
mean, it would probably be too punitive for us to find out who is writing the Chirons, but it might be interesting from, like, if we had a public ombudsman say, this is how this happened, how we called El Salvador a Mexico.
Just keep on. Does anybody notice it on the show?
Potentially shutting down the southern border. Or 2 days ago. Excuse me. No, that's yesterday. Weekend is just 2 days.
2 days.
But yesterday we also heard that this is a big move. This is one of the few punitive measures the executive branch has still to these countries to say, get it under control. We've been giving you aid for decades. We want your societies to be better, your economies to be better, because right now there's a huge magnetic pull to our southern border. That's going to be we'll see if that leads to any changes in policy in those countries.
Yeah. Now, see, this is the belief that these lunatics have, that it's just simply the magnetism of the United States that is pulling them there, as opposed to report after report after report of the incredible amounts of violence and danger that is in these countries for these people. It's grotesque. It really is. But, oh, gosh.
Which Mexico is your favorite, Matt?
Uruguay.
You know, I would like to go to a Mexico in my own mind. And as you know, stress is a worldwide epidemic. I was a wreck throughout last week, and then Friday came, and then it was just like, oh, finally the week. Oh, not the weekend. We're working longer hours. We're inundated with the constant news cycle. Tell me about it. And we're more connected than ever before. Stress is a part of life, and it can easily affect our overall health and well-being. That's why we're partnering with Calm, the number one app to help reduce your anxiety and stress and help you sleep better. More than 40 million people around the world have downloaded it. If you head to calm.com/majority, you'll get 25% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes guided meditations on issues like anxiety, stress, and focus, including a brand new meditation each day, Sleep Stories, which are bedtime stories for adults designed to help you relax. You can head to the magical lavender fields of southern France with allergies like I have. With Stephen Fry, or you can explore the moonlit jungles of Africa with Leona Lewis. They have soothing music and much, much more. Right now, Majority Report listeners get 25% off of a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/majority. That's calm.com/majority. Get unlimited access to all of Calm's content today at calm.com/majority. Get Calm. And stop stressing. Also, have you heard about Joybird? They got a store right around the corner. Have you been there? I've checked out their furniture quite a bit. And I have to say, with a longing eye, it's the company behind the revolution of online furniture shopping. Joybird offers a one-of-a-kind furniture made to your unique tastes. You turn your ideas into reality with hundreds of styles and options. From mid-century modern to contemporary classics, all customizable in an amazing array of fabric choices from rich buttery leather to plush velvets to every color imaginable. There's even a wide range of kid and pet-friendly upholstery available. I wish back in the day we knew of something like that. Because my children have destroyed all of the furniture over the years, as well as a free personal design consultant to help you nail down your perfect design. And with Joybird's 365-day home trial, you can skip the furniture store and bring the showroom home. Sleep on it, sit on it, break it in. If you don't love your Joybird, return it for a full refund. In-home delivery is hassle-free. They'll even remove all the packaging materials. And returns are free within 2 weeks of delivery. See how Joybird is revolutionizing online furniture shopping. Create the furniture that brings you joy today at joybird.com/majority. Go to joybird.com/majority and receive an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order by using the code MAJORITY. Check it out, folks. joybird.com/majority. They have a couple of chairs that swivel. That I have been eyeing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you just got to use that spray. It keeps my children off of the furniture.
You don't have any children.
Well, they're cats, but same difference.
Spray water on your cats or on your kid. Yeah, I just don't want to be around for that. And lastly, folks, there's no need to suffer through another sleepless night. I used this last night. Do you notice?
Oh, yeah.
I am a little more refreshed than normal.
There is some spring in your step today, I must say.
I had my calming comfort. I opened the window a little bit, got it a little cool in the apartment, dropped the calming comfort by Sharper Image on me. It's a luxurious weighted blanket. It's made with super soft velveteen material and designed with high-density comfort fill to promote a sense of calmness. Yeah. I don't know how calm I was, but I definitely slept better. By applying an even amount of pressure over your body, calming comfort helps the production of serotonin and melatonin, and it mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged for a restful night's sleep. Like I say, used it last night, slept.
When I was in Phoenix, I had my hotel room had a very light comforter on it, and I had trouble sleeping because I'm used to really heavy. I have a very drafty room in Brooklyn here, so I used a lot of heavy blankets, and it's much more pleasurable to
you
sleep.
So you got that, that's the Dakotan way of doing it, right?
Yeah,
you just throw the window open.
It It's cozier that way.
Calm and Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free, stress-free, best night's sleep of your life guarantee from the Sharper Image. Right now, our listeners can go to calmingcomfortblanket.com. That's calmingcomfortblanket.com, all one word. Well, not the .com part, it's the dot and then com. And use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout to receive $15 off the displayed price. Again, that's calmingcomfortblanket.com. Promo code MAJORITY, because you cannot put a price on a great night's sleep. Calmingcomfortblanket.com. Promo code MAJORITY. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be back with Khaled Bedoun. Right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of Law at the University of Arkansas and author of American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear, Khaled Bedoun. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the your book basically argues that Islamophobia is actually rooted in our law and policy. And I think most people, you know, sort of tend to think of it as just sort of a private disposition. And you talk about the sort of the different areas where it manifests itself. But how is it rooted in our law and policy? And I guess maybe as a second part of that, is this unique to American society?
Well, first, it's critical to understand that Islamophobia is a state-sponsored and structural process that is rooted in longstanding American law, not only American law, but the way in which legal institutions have perceived Islam as a religion and Muslims as a people. So in the book, I talk about how many of the founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, the individuals who drafted the Constitution, essentially looked at Islam as being this antithetical civilization that represented tyranny, that represented, you know, undemocratic principles that they wanted to shape their country, the United States, into the mirror opposite of. So they saw Islam as kind of the representation of everything undemocratic.
So let's go back. Let's go back from a historical standpoint to see the development of that. Where does it start?
Well, it starts, you know, at the very earliest embryonic stages of the creation of the United States. You know, one piece of law that sort of, I guess, highlights how Islamophobia was embedded in early legal structures was this Naturalization Act of 1790, which was enacted, you know, shortly after the drafting of the Constitution, which effectively stated that you had to be white to become a naturalized citizen. And because Islam as a religion was viewed as a race or a rival sort of civilization, individuals who adhered to you know, Islam could not would not be deemed white and therefore could not become citizens. And this law persisted all the way up until 1952. So you had immigrants coming from the Arab world through the early and mid 20th centuries who were freely exercising the religion in line with the First Amendment. But because they identified as Muslim, could not become naturalized citizens because Islam was viewed to be antithetical to white identity. And we obviously see that rhetoric reemerging with not only Donald Trump, but this new brazen form of white supremacy and white populism.
I just want to stay a little bit with the Naturalization Act of 1790 and then the two major Supreme Court cases, U.S. Versus Thind and Ozawa.
Yeah.
And just tease that out for us in terms of because the Naturalization Act of 1790 did not specifically say you have to be white, did it? I mean, and in many respects, it created a concept of white.
No, it did. Specifically, it said you have to be white. It was written into the actual explicit letter of the law itself. Whiteness was a full-fledged prerequisite for naturalized citizenship. And so basically what happened is that civil court judges effectively had to go back and they had authority over defining what white meant.
Okay.
You know, obviously white was very fluid. At, you know, one juncture, Irish Americans who came in the middle of the 19th century were not deemed white. Jewish Americans were not deemed white on account of religious identity. So the law specifically said one had to be white. And then judges had, again, the latitude in determining what white meant. So the two Supreme Court decisions you highlight, one involving a sick immigrant individual from India, wore a turban, had the beard, brown skin, 1922 case, came before the Supreme Court and argued, hey, I'm from the South Asian Peninsula. This is where Aryan identity originates from. I should be somebody who fits within the statutory definition of whiteness. And what's critical to understand is that civil court judges had different conceptions as to what white actually meant. Some of them looked to the actual physical appearance of the individual. Some of them looked to geographic origin. Some of them looked to the religious identity. So there was an arbitrary sort of assessment as to what white meant, depending on who the judge was. In the Thind case, the judge said that this man, Bhagat Thind, would not pass what he called the common man test, meaning that the common American would not view Thind as being white because of his phenotypical or physical appearance. So he was denied whiteness. A year later in Ozawa, this involved a Japanese resident of California, somebody who was, you know, assimilated in almost every way, attended the University of California at Berkeley, spoke perfect English, could even pass as white in some respects in terms of the way he dressed and sort of performed his identity. And he was denied whiteness and then denied citizenship on account of him being of Japanese origin. So these two Supreme Court decisions demonstrate how much authority judges had in exercising what the definition of whiteness meant.
And so what made Islam or Muslims unique in that context of that function, I guess?
Yeah, so Muslims were between this sort of position where religious identity was central to what whiteness meant. Up through the naturalization era, Christianity was very much a cornerstone of whiteness. You know, for a long time, Protestantism was almost synonymous with whiteness. Catholicism was obviously viewed to be a religion that could not be meshed with whiteness, same for Judaism. Now, Islam definitely, still today, is viewed as a religion that is inimical or antithetical to whiteness. So Muslims, in some of them who could physically pass, as white based on the way they look, many of them from, you know, modern day Lebanon or Syria, for instance, oftentimes had to change their name, had to convert to Christianity, or at least perform that they weren't Muslims before civil court judges in order to fit within the statutory definition of whiteness, because Islam up until 1944 was categorically viewed to be a racial/religious identity that could not be meshed with whiteness.
Interesting. So Christianity was just one piece of evidence that you would put into the docket, I guess. But Islam was one piece of evidence which would necessarily disqualify you.
Yeah, and I would also not limit the importance of Christianity as a gateway toward whiteness. I think that it was a, one might even say, a piece of evidence that could be determinative. And like you said, Muslim identity would be something that would disqualify you. Up until 1944, there was a pivotal case called Ex parte Mohriez, which shifts that determination for Arab Muslims specifically, largely based on the United States, you know, forging this new relationship with Saudi Arabia, and the immigrant in that case was Saudi Arabian. So it's a really complex history.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess, I mean, I'm just, you know, like, you know, I mean, I guess it's quite obvious that our you know, let's say anti-black racism is also rooted in our legal structures, right? I mean, like, we literally had a, you were literally had to, the law said you could be a slave. And so, and what does that do in terms of its durability? I mean, as we move forward in time, what does that do in terms of the durability of Islamophobia?
I think what it does is, and what I try to highlight in the book is that there's this deeply embedded, you know, immense and extensive sort of treasure trove of tropes and stereotypes that exist that are not new. I mean, the idea that, you know, Muslims could not be assimilated, the idea that Muslims are savage and backwards and sort of like are wed to, you know, tyranny, you know, everything we hold dear in the United States as a democratic country. These have been rooted by legal decisions, rooted by legal discourses. So when something happens in the States in terms of, let's say, you know, a terror crisis, or we have a culprit that's Muslim with some sort of deviant act, these things are readily available deep within the American imagination that are then redeployed.
All right. So let's talk about the the law provides the sort of the structural basis for this Islamophobia, and then it gets I don't know what to say. It's a downstream from that law is private Islamophobia, and then this dialectical. Explain the private and the dialectical manifestations of Islamophobia.
Yes, I think if you were to watch the news, right, and, you know, somebody like Anderson Cooper talking about Islamophobia or, you know, a mainstream pundit of, you know, discussing the issue, there's always a fixation, almost an exclusive sort of fixation on private Islamophobic acts. And by private Islamophobia, I mean, you know, violent acts that are unleashed by an individual, right, a hate monger, a bigot of some kind. We can look at what happened in New Zealand with the terrorists walking into the Linwood and El Nur mosques as a clear example of private Islamophobia. And what I try to demonstrate in the book is to not view these acts or incidents of private Islamophobia as being aberrant, as being untied to state action. State-sponsored Islamophobia by way of law and policy, things like the Muslim ban, for instance, or surveillance within mosques, counter-radicalization policing, are embedded upon the same presumption, right? The presumption being that Muslim identity or expressions of Muslim identity are in some way connected or correlated to terrorism. That's typically the idea that sort of drives private Islamophobes to attack Muslims, right? The idea that Muslims are this kind of, you know, terror and hiding community, sleeper cell or whatever, that warrants them engaging in vigilante violence. So the dynamic is one where the law sort of endorses individuals having these negative stereotypes of Muslims on the ground, and during moments of crisis more than endorses, but actually emboldens private actors to partake in this broader sort of civilizational project of punishing and policing Muslims, right? And we see this happening during moments of, you know, intense Islamophobic rhetoric. So when somebody like Donald Trump is saying things like Islam hates us, or, you know, Muslim immigrants are invaders, that is more than just rhetoric from a politician or a president. In the book, I talk about how that's actually a dictate, right, from somebody from high office effectively communicating to the broader polity or his broader audience to take action of some kind, to be vigilant, or in some respects, if the sort of the audience member is somebody who has vile sort of views and, you know, has violent proclivities, sort of authorizing indirectly the kind of violence we see unfolding in New Zealand, or the kind of violence we see unfolding a couple of years back at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where three Muslim American students were murdered not far from the Chapel Hill campus. And that is the dialectic, one in which the rhetoric, the action, the law from the state functions to authorize and embolden the vigilante violence we see from hate mongers, bigots, and terrorists.
Was there a, talk about the sort of the interim period, or, you know, because it feels like, I am old enough to remember the Iranian hostage crisis and the demonization of Iranian, I knew some good Iranian kids who were, you know, growing up, and that was horrific for them. But where... was there an ebb and flow in terms of how our law saw Muslim folks and Islam? And did we see any commensurate sort of change in the sort of the private? This is all, of course, pre 9/11, where I think, you know, in many respects, all bets are off. But I'm curious just how, you know, when we're talking about the sort of the middle part of in the middle and late part of the 20th century, like what was this the status of both Islamophobia within the law and, you know, amongst within the private sector?
No, great question. I think one way you can frame it is ebb and flow. The way I like to think about it is in terms of priority. How is the state prioritizing Muslim or, you know, perceived Muslim threat in terms of its national security sort of objectives? So before 9/11, and especially before or during the Cold War, Muslim threat wasn't as much of a priority for several reasons, right? We were engaged in this kind of civilizational strife with the Soviet Union, which sort of occupied, positionality of being the primary American threat on a geopolitical stage. When the Cold War is over, then you see a shift, both in terms of rhetoric from the state, but also in terms of, marshaling actual resources and energy to fighting Muslim threat. You have the beginning of the Iraq War, with the first Bush administration continued onward with a full-fledged war, obviously, with the second Bush administration. But 9/11 is critical in being a sort of flashpoint that enables the state to do two things. It sort of formalizes the idea that Muslim threat is our primary civilizational and geopolitical concern, and we see that with the naming of the actual war as the War on Terror. But also, there's also, I think, a second shift. The idea that Muslim threat is manifested by this new wave of transnational terror networks that did not exist or were not as sort of, you know, pervasive and as prominent before 9/11. Before 9/11, we were more concerned with nation states, specifically Iran and Iraq. Iran being, a 12-year Shia government. Iraq, actually, ironically enough, being a secular Ba'athi regime. But the threat was coming specifically from governments or individuals within those governments that held a lot of authority, Saddam Hussein and the Ayatollah Khomeini, Iraq and Iran, respectively. After 9/11, we're not concerned as much with nation states. We're concerned with Al-Qaeda. We're concerned with ISIS. We're concerned with these networks that we think can then radicalize Muslim American citizens stateside. So Muslim threat before 9/11 was represented by governments, after 9/11 by terror networks that have some sort of deep connection with Muslim Americans and communities here in the States.
We have this dynamic, and I imagine, you know, things like actual movements. I mean, there seems to me to be like almost like a subsidiary structure to the law, right, and to policy, which are almost, you know, I don't know what to call them, networks, cottage industries, you know, that we saw like manifested in like the Ground Zero, the Ground Zero mosque protests. And, you know, there are substructures that are not governmental, but are not, you know, sort of they're private, but they're more than just, you know, individuals and more than just people expressing Islamophobia, like the Frank Gaffneys and the structures that seem to be around it. And then I want to talk about sort of like almost, you know, sort of this new era of intellectualized Islamophobia. But let's talk about the sort of the Gaffney style stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that, you know, when vilifying Islam and when the war on terror developed into a primary commitment on the part of the state, what you have is, you know, like you framed, the subsidiary emergence of an industry, right? An academic industry, a punditry, think tanks who wanted to cash in on what was going in and sort of develop, you know, I say thinkers with quotes around thinkers, who could speak on what's happening in a way that was palatable to the state. So before the development of the Islamophobia industry as we know it today, with people like Frank Gaffney or Spencer, the likes of these kinds of characters, you had these sort of established Orientalists, people like Bernard Lewis and Fuad Ajami, who sort of laid the foundation, right? They were already, you know, kind of established in developing, you know, academic works that legitimized the idea that the Islamic world was in fact a monolith, the fact that, you know, Muslim identity was foreshadowing of some sort of terror threat. And you saw these guys having close relationships with the presidential administrations all the way up to the Bush administration, and also becoming really influential with think tanks in Washington, D.C. So these, we can call them the sort of founding father Islamophobes, you know, Samuel Huntington, I'd include in that same sort of class, opening the door for the likes of Gaffney and the likes of even the pundits we see on television. Bridget Gabriel comes to mind on Fox News, this new wave of hardline atheist Islamophobe Sam Harris, who was engaged in a really interesting communication with Juan Cole, Islamic studies professor at the University of Michigan yesterday.
I saw that.
You saw that?
I saw that on Twitter. That was quite, it was started with Mehdi Hassan and Juan Cole. It was pretty good.
It was really good. And I think that conversation like really highlights sort of problems with the Islamophobia industry, is that these are individuals, you know, whether it be Gaffney or Sam Harris, these are individuals who don't have specific training, don't have the education in Islam or Islamic studies to make, you know, expert, objective
assessments
of what it is they're talking about.
All right. Well, Professor, let me just for the sake of fairness, I think Sam Harris would say, really, Professor? Well, then alert my friends. And then he would list five friends he had who are either Muslim or formerly identified as Muslims. So he's got that.
Yeah, but Muslim identity is by no means a credential, right? Being a Muslim does not make one, you know, an expert on Sharia law. I'm a Muslim American. I study American law. I know Sharia law, you know, generally, but I can't speak to the nuances. I can't speak to the distinct schools of thought. And that's the problem, right? I think that
right. Well, know, I'm an American, and I am also not an expert on American law.
Exactly. There you go. So identity is by no means expertise. So Sam Harris's argument is an easy one to sort of dismantle.
But what, I mean, so what are the, because, you know, like I look at the Gaffneys and the Harrises is that they are in many respects part of the same animal. I'm not saying they're coordinating with each other or in any way affiliated, but from a sort of a, from looking at like the structure in society, some are working sort of the more inside game, the more policy game, and then others function to provide almost like a foaming the runway, you know, or maybe, you know, foaming the runway for sort of the intellectual acceptance of this. I mean, has there been a project like that, specifically the, like, let's work on this aspect. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, sort of like brute in terms of brute proclamations associating the you know, Islam with terrorism. And we do that by saying, you know, we can have a Muslim ban. We can have extensive spying on people who are, you know, in Islamic youth groups in college or whatnot. But has there been a project like this where we're going to really sort of appeal this level of like a soft Islamophobia that we're going to sort of dress up as an intellectual exercise? I mean, because you talk about anti-blackness in the relationship with Islamophobia, and we've had in the past intellectual movements to describe why whites are why white supremacy is actually intellectually justified, not just morally or you know, in terms of God. I mean, is this a phenomenon we've seen before in terms of Islam?
I think so, but it's obviously catching steam. And I think the fact that it's so popular now, and also, you know, I think a mode of thinking that is not only exclusive to the right, but is that definitely pervading the center and also the left, is because there's political will and sort of power behind these quasi-intellectuals disseminating these negative ideas or even flat ideas of Islam and of Muslims. And that connection is really important. I think the work of – I would never, you know, try to understate the – at least the influence of a Sam Harris or a Majid Nawaz. These are individuals who are, you know, selling books, New York Times bestsellers, you know, filling stadiums. They have millions of followers on Twitter. So their message is definitely effective and is resonant. And the large reason why it's effective and resonant is because they have a president like Donald Trump and movements within Washington, D.C. That repackage their messages in ways that are palatable to lay voters, right? So what Trump says in signing the executive order known as the Muslim ban is not – it's sort of a – translated sort of version of what Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz sort of like, you know, peddle off as being real academic work. So the connection between what they're doing is really, really important, really potent in terms of, you know, having real effect in the political sphere. Has it happened before? Not to this extent. I think that Islamophobia and Orientalism is more profuse today for a range of reasons. I think part of it is tied to, we can talk about the sort of inverse of white supremacy taking place today with this new moment of white anxiety, or you know, some people even call it white paranoia, because of shifting demographics. So the landscape is really ripe for Islamophobia in both message and policy to be very resonant because of demographic shifts, because of, you know, a new sort of racial justice and racial consciousness awakening on the left. And I think third and most importantly, and I'm not sure if you want to discuss this more closely, but this rise in sort of identity politics that is taking place on the far right and the far left, where there's a, I would say, dangerous fixation on identity in ways that facilitate the rise of forms of bigotry like Islamophobia, anti-black racism, white supremacy, and anti-Semitism in ways that we hadn't seen in a really long time.
Yeah, I do want to get into that. That sounds fascinating. I want to get into that, but I want to make sure that I'm clear in terms of the idea that rising white anxiety is, it's almost as if like there's less latitude for us to express anti-black sentiments in the context of or racist sentiments. So we're gonna whitewash it or launder it through an anti-Muslim sentiment, because that's a choice that people are making, or we're talking about now a bad idea, not a we're not being so essentialist. Is that the theory there? Is that what you mean by that?
I think that's part of the theory. I think what Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz like to say is like, look, Islamophobia, and they don't even call it Islamophobia. They dismiss the entire sort of framing.
Right. They don't think the word means anything. Right.
Exactly. They think that anti-Muslim animus is a rational form of discrimination based on the threat that is being posed by Islam and by Muslims. So they would not analogize Islamophobia and anti-black racism. I think if you sat down with Sam Harris and Majid Nawaz, they'd say, look, racism against black folks is wrong. They would also say that being anti-Semitic is entirely wrong. These are individuals who you'd have to sort of, if you were to kind of classify them along the political spectrum, they'd probably be a lot closer to the left than the right on most issues.
Right. Right.
Right. But they think that discrimination against Muslims is rational and also serves the best interests of the state. So they view it as entirely distinct from these other forms of bigotry.
Right. And that's not, there's a lot of bigots, I think, who probably feel that way about their own bigotry, right?
Like, yeah,
it's a perfectly rational thing. I mean, God, God did not mean us to commingle. And So talk about this theory that you have about identity politics. I mean, it's clear to me that, identity politics on the far right, I mean, translates into a certain amount of white supremacy, yeah. Right? And so that's a pretty straightforward, roadmap to being anti-Muslim. How does it function on the left, in your opinion?
Well, there's a range of sort of perils that also exist on the left, and I'll name two of them for the sake of brevity. Number one, the idea, and we saw this, manifested in the exchange between Harris and Juan Cole. So Harris and Nawaz both critiqued Juan Cole for not being an expert, even though he has a PhD in Islamic studies and studied in Cairo at Azhar, can boast a resume that few have with regard to study of Islam, entirely based on him being a white male. So him being a white male excludes him from being able to speak on these issues. And this is a view that's pervasive on the left, to be frank with you. I think many far left activists and, even pundits have very sadly sort of conflated expertise with identity and in some respects supplanted the importance of expertise with this fixation on identity. There's a brilliant piece by fellow law professor Nancy Leong called Racial Capitalism, which does a great job sort of, meticulously analyzing this phenomenon. So the danger with that sort of position, and representation is important, and I'm a critical race theorist and I can tell you how important representation is, but there's been a disposing of expertise for the sake of racial optics in bringing in somebody to speak on issues just because they look the part, if that makes any sense.
Yes. I mean, and I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's not to say that, that's not the same argument as just because I'm a white guy doesn't mean I can't have an opinion on this. It's to say that expertise counts. Okay.
And that's it. I mean, if somebody like Juan Cole, who's a white male, but has been studying Islamic studies for his entire life and, and is in the sort of like upper one percentile of these issues, his opinion does not only count, but it should be seriously considered and heard.
Right. So there's
Right.
So there's a certain amount of you get a certain amount of credibility for having a lived experience. But expertise still has a huge import in these things.
Yeah, no, lived experience matters considerably. Matters considerably, right? But so does training. So does expertise. And again, you and I are both American, right? Being American does not make us, experts on the First Amendment. Does not make us experts on, American administrative law. Doesn't make us an expert in a whole host of issues. So identity might be sort of a segue into knowing about a specific subject matter, but expertise should be considered to be the most salient sort of metric of knowledge.
It is sort of fascinating to me that identity politics is, I mean, we see it wielded obviously by white supremacists, right? I mean, that's a fairly obvious calculation.
Yeah.
But to see it leveraged by someone like Sam Harris, as he did in that exchange, and we see this all the time, I'm not, you guys are caught up in identity politics. You're so worried. I mean, in a political field, you're so caught up in this idea of identity politics. But look here, I have a black friend. And so,
of course, yeah.
I mean, that type of dynamic is sort of it's fascinating to sort of see how much it's being utilized as, in many respects, a justification for some type of either discriminatory actions or beliefs.
No, definitely. And I think for me, who, you know, somebody who, you know, thinks about these issues really closely, I think the most unfortunate sort of development in the political discourse is there's really no more nuance, right? There's no more sort of, you know, careful criticism. And look, there's we can carefully critique specific segments of the broader Muslim global milieu that is dangerous, that is vile, and that should be considered, you know, an element that we have to confront, you know, whether it's the Saudi regime, whether it's terror networks, whether it's specific interpretations of Islamic doctrine that is problematic. That is true, but that is only a sliver of the broader population. The reality that we have in this discourse right now is people are talking in terms of hyperbole. People are flattening entire experiences, and people are discussing entire groups as monoliths. And the sad reality is that it's not only happening at the sort of bottom of the political discourse. The individuals that are sort of being wielded out as our thinkers of the day and our, you know, most influential pundits are also engaging in that, you know, very flat and, you know, vapid sort of conversation as well.
And it's not just simply a question of the quantity, even in the context of something like Saudi Arabia. We're talking about the interplay of Islam with a whole host of historical and economic contextual issues and power dynamics. And it's really, I mean, to examine that stuff is really to examine how these various factors, I guess, interrelate with each other and play off each other.
Exactly. I think that we definitely see that with the present sort of discussion on Islam globally speaking. We see domestically with the way Islamophobia is framed. I would just, you know, somebody who wrote this book, I think what I'm trying to do with this book specifically is to counter what people like Sam Harris, Gaffney are doing on the Islamophobia side and bring some care, bring some, you know, again, some careful analysis to what's going on in a way to hope, you know, hopefully bring some thoughtfulness back to the conversation, if that's not an impossible sort of objective.
Well, I guess hope springs eternal, right? But lastly, so let me ask you that. I mean, that's the to some extent the private realm. What is the opportunities for structural change?
Well, the opportunities for structural change, I think, hinge considerably on what happens politically, right? So if we get a Democratic administration succeed this one, the Sanders administration specifically, which I think is the most robust in countering Islamophobia, we could see a doing away with the executive order known as the Muslim ban, with a subsequent executive order that quashes it or does away with it. So that's, you know, one imminent hope that I have that, again, hinges on this next presidential election. Also, the shape of the courts, right? The Supreme Court is one that upheld the Muslim ban largely because it's now been packed with originalist or conservative justices brought in by the Trump administration. So, you know, another objective in the short term is to sort of cultivate a court that is more, I would say, keen on delivering the promise of the First Amendment, specifically free exercise of religion and establishment clause, that enables sort of a structural dismantling or at least diminishing of Islamophobia.
Khaled Beydoun, author of American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear. Thanks so much for your time today. We will put a link to your book at majority.fm. Real pleasure talking to you.
No, thanks so much. I really appreciate the conversation.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. All right, folks. That is our first half of our program. We will head into the fun half of the show. Michael is going to be joining us. We maybe he'll fill us in on the Well, it's April Fool's, so I pretend to be concerned about the look. He brought his medical bracelet to prove that he was actually in the hospital.
I'm sorry, that camera's not working.
That camera's not working?
Or it's not on. I didn't think Michael was going to be here, so I didn't set up the shot.
Oh, well, there it is. Maybe we'll take a photo and we'll print it. Here, I'll tweet it out. Put it on the blog.
Oh, I got the wide shot.
Oh, look at that. He's brought his bracelet. He's got an excuse for what? Bring it over here. I'll read this.
All right, don't read any personal details
aloud. Michael, hold your bracelet up for the
this is confirmation. The, Brooklyn Hospital.
We thought you might have been pranking us by not appearing on a Monday.
Patient name, Michael Brooks. Attending caregiver, Holly. We're not going to give her last name. Excuse from work, school, or physical activity. Michael Brooks needs to be excused from checked work. Beginning now through the following date, April 1st, 2019.
Wait, that's a whole day?
Well,
goodbye, guys.
Tune into TMBS tomorrow. She may return, checked off, to full activity as of 4/2/2019. I can't.
Oh, all right. So actually, that's the whole day. So am I up, Matt?
Wow.
Okay, I'll see you guys for TMBS tomorrow. Take care, guys. And also, live show in L.A. Good. Enjoy the rest of the show.
I hope you get over your case of the Mondays. It sounds really serious.
Yeah,
it was very serious Monday.
Looking at what the...
Don't actually read.
I'm not going to read it, but this is... Oh, my God. Oh, my God. This is great. Oh. I might pay you to put this on our Instagram. This
Wow, that's a lot of pages.
I don't live in starvation wages from you anymore, so I'm not going to. I don't have that level of desperation for you to abuse me with.
Three words which describe the malady.
And they had the worst cover-up ever.
Oh, my God. If I'll tell you what.
Nikki says hi.
If anybody on Twitter can guess what the three word, they'll never guess.
Oh,
but yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's why I'm going to offer $50 cash. Just tag Michael and guess the three words on what it is.
I won't get your notifications anyways.
Also, folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Michael has, as far as I can tell, a doctor's note that will allow him to do his show tomorrow night.
I asked the specialist if I could do my show tomorrow night, and they said yes, but to limit my exposure to Sam. Tomorrow night, Kim Ives, investigative reporter and editor of Haiti Liberation. We're talking, I don't know, does anybody remember the story that happened a couple of weeks ago or several weeks ago? We were on vacation. I was in Puerto Rico and this group of mercenaries was arrested in Haiti. Three Americans, one, you don't remember the story. So it's actually, they were arrested with like a massive van filled with weapons. They told the cop, we answer to somebody higher. The cop said, no, you don't. They arrested them, but then they were basically flown out of the country a day later, and the U.S. said superficially, like, oh, we'll look into it, and they immediately returned. And so we're going to go into what the true story behind that was. Then Malaika Jabali is joining us to explain why Hillary actually lost Wisconsin and why that matters for winning 2020. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
Didn't she write that piece already?
She has a new piece in The Root.
Okay.
But that's, yes, I would say The Color of Inequality is a great piece, yes.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we gang-splained Brexit with the help of our friend Niril Shah. Also, we released a bonus for our patrons where a few of our valued patrons call into the show, including a really awkward call from Paul Joseph Watson. So that was interesting. And over the weekend, we recorded a show about the Gilets Jaunes uprising, which is still ongoing in France. So check it out, folks. The Antifada.
Also check out the Literary Hangover. The episode recorded last week on this Oscar Wilde's The Soul of Man Under Socialism will be out on Saturday.
Oh, hell yeah.
Oh, with Griscom?
With David Griscom of the Griscom Economic Minute on TMBS.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half, 646-257-3920. Just a reminder, folks, Calming Comfort by Sharper Image. Calming Comfort by Sharper Image is the luxurious weighted blanket that's designed with high-density comfort fill to promote a sense of calmness for a restful night's sleep. The Calming Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free best nights of sleep of your life guarantee from Sharper Image. Right now, our listeners can go to calmingcomfortblanket.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout to receive $15 off the displayed price. Again, that's calmingcomfortblanket.com. Promo code MAJORITY, because you can't put a price on a great night's sleep.